workout summary. Total time, 27 minutes.
Usually, when I go for a run, I strap a smartphone to my arm and I use a running app to monitor my workout. But for a lot of people, activity monitoring is way more of a full-time pursuit.
Yeah, so I got a fitness tracker in around May last year.
This is my friend Keegan, and I'm sure we all know someone like Keegan, someone who swears by these devices.
Over the years, I've lost weight quickly, put it on pretty quickly after celebrating the weight loss, so I wanted something that I could track and keep track of and stay on top of things.
And how's it worked for you?
It's really good. The best thing about it, as opposed to any sort of other motivation, is that it's always there. It's at your wrist and you go, you get a reminder that, by the way, you haven't made this many steps. And coupled with the idea that my parents got one recently, and there's a leader tally that you can compare yourself to on that tally, and my dad always likes to egg me on. So it's a community element as well as just motivating myself. So if you have a day off, it drops down, then you go, all right, well, I'm going to make up for it today. And you make it double or nothing for the next day and have some bets and put some beers on it. So it's good.
Hey, I'm Joel Werner, and today on The Health Report, we're going to see how anecdote squares up against science in the fitness tracker revolution. Witness the fitness, the comfort to live at. One hope, one quest. Witness the
fitness, the comfort to live at. One hope, one quest. It's estimated that about 1 in 6 consumers in the United States use some form of wearable technology.
Wristbands, smartwatches, on belt, headbands, smart rings.
We have a device that continuously tracks different behavioral or physiological parameters such as
movements and activities,
distance,
perspiration, heart rate,
breathing rate,
calories,
their diet,
how many steps you did in a particular day,
or temperature,
their sleep patterns, even their sexual activity.
And this creates a kind of a historical profile of how you're doing.
So there's many, many aspects of our bodies these days that these devices can monitor and measure and track.
There's so much we could talk about when it comes to activity monitoring, but today we're going to focus on consumer wearables, the kind of products that you'd buy off the shelf or the ones that you might already own.
These devices have been on the market domestically for, I think, about 5 years.
Robert Furberg is a senior clinical informaticist at RTI International, a non-profit research institute in North Carolina.
I would say that what we see now in the last 2 years is this incredibly vibrant uptake of these devices that are intended to measure seemingly inconsequential things about an individual's daily life and then convert those measurements into discrete data that can be used to provide feedback to individuals and hopefully aid them in kind of reaching some sort of positive health outcome.
Well, that was the motivation for David anyway.
Yeah, I mean, we've been together 8 years, married for now 3.5.
He and his wife made a New Year's resolution that's probably familiar to a lot of us, to get fit and healthy. So they each bought a Fitbit, a popular wristband activity tracker, and for David at least, the device worked pretty much as you'd expect.
So far, so good. I've actually lost about 9 pounds, which is probably what I gained over the holiday week, to be honest. But at least I'm back to where I was before. It's helped me get more active. I've been hitting my step goal, walking more. I can't really have too many complaints about the tracker.
But his wife, on the other hand,
she nudged me in bed last week and said, hey, I think something's wrong with my Fitbit. I saw that she had accumulated 10 hours in what they call the fat burning zone. And her average heart rate was close to 100 with, you know, spikes up to 115. And that was a pretty normal day for her as far as working at her job. It wasn't like she was running a marathon or anything like that. I thought, okay, maybe something's defective with the watch. Maybe for some reason the sensor's broken, or maybe she's not wearing it correctly, or maybe it needs to be reset or recalibrated in some way, shape, or form.
So David took to the internet in search of a solution. He posted a description of the problems with his wife's device in the Fitbit subreddit, an online message board that hosts discussions for Fitbit users. And at first, the replies were kind of just shots in the dark.
So I got a couple of answers, you know, one saying, hey, the latest Fitbit update has messed with the sensor a little bit, so that might be an issue.
But then, something way more intriguing. A user posted,
hey, has she been really stressed out lately? Or is it possible that she's pregnant? You know, right away I panicked a little bit because, you know, we had for about 2 months been trying to have our first child. So I knew it was a possibility. I responded immediately and said, pregnancy is a strong possibility. And if that's the case, you know, then if I'm going to be a dad, I need to worry about my heart rate at this point.
But had the internet got it right?
I called my wife and I said, listen, you know, these people on the forum suggested that you might be pregnant. So she went to the store that night, got a test, took the test, passed the test, I guess you could say. And then I made her take about 6 more tests in probably a 12-hour span, which all came back positive. I think like any parents, we were overjoyed, a little bit shocked, definitely a little bit scared. But, you know, overall, we were just really excited. We laughed about the fact that somebody on Reddit kind of predicted it. You know, I actually found out that my wife was pregnant through Fitbit.
To date, there are no plans to incorporate any fitness tracker branding into the kid's name. So clearly these trackers are measuring something. But what? Here's Robert Furberg.
The trackers perform best when measuring steps, because that's really what this device was intended to measure. And so when you take a series of steps that have been measured over the course of a minute, then you can start to characterize intensity of physical activity level. I took many more steps within 1 minute because I was running as opposed to walking, as opposed to sitting on my couch. But I tend to have this data model in my head of a series of concentric circles. And so at the center, you have this unit of step that's measured on the device. And there are a series of almost kind of derivative calculations that are executed against that step. So we might say, great job, Joel. You took 10,000 steps last night because we are estimating your stride length. You have run 4 kilometers. But then beyond that, it's not just you've taken 10,000 steps and run 4 kilometers, but that in doing so, you have burned 1,500 calories. I think each example kind of represents another sort of outer ring of the circle. So the further you get away from the actual measurement on the device itself, the greater the likelihood of introducing some mathematical error.
But you can work with the device to make it more accurate. All you've got to do is tell it more about yourself. Here's Keegan again.
So I track my weight every day. I make sure I weigh myself every day, but I also track all of my calories. So every time I have a snack, I'll log it in. And I've just done some basic maths that says I need a calorie deficit of 700 in a day. If you do that for 10 days, you lose a kilo.
And it's through this process of personalization that a lot of users learn more about diet and exercise and sometimes a bit more about themselves.
It's allowing you to quantify the success and the failure. So if you don't lose weight, you know why. And traditionally, that hasn't really been something you could do. You'd try something and it wouldn't work and you would assume it's because you weren't good enough at exercising or you're eating the wrong foods. But now you can actually see what's happening and why it's happening.
So sure, you can augment the kind of basic data collected by your fitness tracker with personal information and make it more accurate, but more accurate than what?
Yeah, so there's been a whole new flood of these types of devices on the market, but there hasn't been really any evaluation of whether or not these devices worked. So we set out to conduct a study to evaluate whether 10 different devices were accurate to track your physical activity.
This is Dr. Mitesh Patel, an assistant professor of medicine and healthcare management at the University of Pennsylvania. He ran a study to figure out just how good fitness trackers are at performing their most basic function, measuring steps.
We had people wearing all of these devices at once. They had a pedometer and 2 accelerometers on their hip. They had 3 wearable devices on the wrist, and then they had an iPhone in one pants pocket and an Android in the other. And we had them come into a gym, step on a treadmill, and we asked them to walk 500 steps, and we had an observer tracking with a step counter, manually counting the steps to ensure it was 500, and then to step off and to show us all 10 devices, and then we would record what the devices said compared to what we had observed. And then we asked them to step back on the treadmill and do it a longer distance, 1,500 steps, and then had them get off and show us what their devices did. And then we had them repeat that. And we did this over 550 times with a variety of participants to get a sense of whether these devices were accurate or not.
And it turns out they were.
The pedometers and accelerometers, as expected, were very accurate and precise. Most of the other devices were also accurate. However, the wearable devices had quite a bit of variability. In fact, there was one wearable device which was 22% off. So it would give you a step count that was 22% lower than what we observed. And what was interesting was the smartphones, which most people carry with them everywhere they go, were just as accurate and oftentimes had less variability than the wearable devices.
So wait a minute. If my smartphone measures steps just as accurately as a fitness tracker, why would I ever wear a fitness tracker? What advantage does these devices have over, you know, just carrying your phone around?
So the first aspect, obviously, is the battery life.
Dr. Lucas Pivek is a research associate at the University of Bath.
If you use your phone for this kind of tracking, it will drain your phone battery more and, you know, you have to recharge it more frequently. While when this sort of functionality is constrained to the wearable band, it doesn't really use the phone battery so much. It's mostly using the wearable battery. The second thing, it's also about the spectrum of the sensors that can be embedded within the armband that are in direct contact with your body. Your phone is not really in the direct contact with your body most of the time, but the wearable has a much closer connection to your body. So there is a potential that there will be even more sophisticated sensors that will be able to track such aspects as a level of sugar in your bloodstream, which would be extremely helpful in some cases.
Like if you're a diabetic. But we'll have more on the medical application of these devices later in the show. So both fitness trackers and smartphones are pretty good at counting steps. But how good are they at transforming that step data into other measurements like distance walked or calories burned? Kelly Evenson is a research professor at the University of North Carolina. She's done a bunch of work at RTI International, which is where she met Robert Furberg.
When I started working with Robert, he was looking at several different devices. And so my question to him as a scientist was, well, which one is the best in terms of measurement? He said, I don't know, you tell me. And so I went to the literature and I gathered all the articles that we could find. Overall, we had 22 studies, and by far the most common measure explored was steps. And we found that most studies, both in the lab and in the field, found that steps were quite accurate from the trackers. We only found one study that explored distance, and distance was overestimated at slower speeds and underestimated when you're going faster, like running. For calories, there were several studies that explored whether the calories burned from the trackers was accurate, and it actually usually underestimated the number of calories burned and did not have very good validity.
And why do you think that is? Is that because calories, it's one of the outer concentric circles, to borrow the metaphor from before? It's more of a calculated outcome?
Yes, I think that's an excellent metaphor to use, yes. So the next parameter was physical activity, and only two studies actually explored whether estimates of physical activity were accurate, and they varied, the two studies, in their results. So we actually felt we could not make a conclusion on whether the trackers were accurate for physical activity. There were a couple studies that explored the validity of sleep, and they actually did quite a good job and compared it to polysomnography, which is the gold standard measure of sleep. And the findings were pretty consistent across the few studies that did look at this. They found that sleep time was actually overestimated by the trackers. And in one study, when the sleep mode setting was set to a finer tune, so to be more sensitive, then the tracker underestimated sleep time. So there's some work to be done to improve sleep time quality. I went into the topic thinking they won't do as well as pedometers, for example, in measuring steps. And I was actually pleasantly surprised. The trackers are doing a good job of measuring steps. And I think with time and with the company's investment in the protocols for how they're deriving these measures, I only see these things improving. Let's get physical.
This is the Health Report on RN, and today we're getting physical with fitness trackers. I'm Joel Werner. So, these devices are good at measuring steps and are pretty good at transforming that step data into other measurements. But that's not really the point, is it? You don't buy a fitness tracker to get a super accurate measurement of, say, how many calories you've burned. You buy a fitness tracker to get fit, to help you lose weight. So, how good are they at that? Here's Mitesh Patel again.
So there's a lot of hope that by tracking our daily behaviors and learning about what we do, that we can take that information and change and be a healthy new person. But there's not a lot of evidence to suggest that that's the case for the people who need to change their behaviors the most. Now, there are the quote-unquote quantified selfers or people that are very motivated and engaged in their health already, and those individuals tend to be able to take this data and literally run with it. Whereas the people who have chronic conditions or obese or diabetes, those folks, giving a device is often not enough, and we really think that we need to pair these technologies with effective behavior change strategies if we want to help people improve their health.
Indeed, one of the big hurdles after you give someone a fitness tracker is to make sure they keep using it. Market research shows that up to 50% of people stop using these devices within the first year of owning one.
And when it comes to sustainability, you know, the challenge is you're taking an individual who's raised their hand and said, I have a problem changing my behavior, I'm going to go out and get a wearable device. And then you're not only asking them to change that behavior, be more physically active, lose weight, take their medicines, quit smoking, whatever it might be, but you're also asking them to do a variety of other tasks, like remember to wear the device every day. Many of these devices require charging on a daily or every other day basis. And then in order to do anything with the data, you often have to sync it to your smartphone or a computer. And it turns out that these small steps really add up to high hurdles.
I think the fitness tracker and the motivation sort of intertwined. I think part of the success of it is that it is a daily reminder of your success. And by the way, this is something you're focused on. But I'm not sure it would have been as much of a success had I not already been motivated.
It's really the motivation that makes the difference. You know, if you've got that kind of motivation with or without a device, you're likely to be more successful than someone who doesn't have the motivation. Now, that device can help you on the path towards achieving your goals. But the key is, how do we give the devices to people, help them sustain their use, you know, make sure that they're accurate in tracking what they say they track, but then find a way to hone in on that motivation. Our group has been conducting randomized clinical trials to test different ways to design financial and social incentives to see how we can harness that intrinsic and extrinsic motivation to change people's behavior.
A common criticism of fitness trackers is that they're just a novelty gadget for people who are already fit and healthy. So Mitesh Patel focused his research on groups that could benefit the most from these devices. He took people who were overweight or obese and examined the effect of a daily financial incentive on their motivation to be active. The control group didn't receive any incentive, but for the three experimental groups, the incentive was worth $1.40 a day and was delivered under one of three conditions.
In the gain arm, they were told every day you reach your step goal, which was 7,000 steps, you'd earn $1.40. There was a lottery arm where you win a lottery, you could win $5 or $50, and mathematically it averaged out to about $1.40. And then there was a loss framing arm where individuals were told $42 has been placed in a virtual account with your name on it. Every day you don't achieve the goal will take $1.40 away. And the results were quite interesting. The control arm, which got no incentive, achieved their goal about 30% of the time. The standard gain arm or the lottery arm achieved their goal 35 to 36% of the time. So slightly higher, but statistically no different than not paying them at all. Whereas the loss framing arm, where we take into account that people really have a hard time giving up things that they have, they achieve the goal 45% of the time, or a 50% relative increase. And this was statistically significant and a huge improvement for essentially no change in the value of the incentive. You know, we tend to respond more to losses than gains. We want immediate gratification. We're not really excited by rewards that are going to happen far into the future. And we're often engaged based on our emotions. So we hate the feeling of regret, not being able to collect a reward that we could have gotten had only we tried a little bit harder. And so if we can leverage those things, we can really design these programs to be more effective.
This is kind of like how Keegan mentioned earlier that he'll bet his dad a round of beers to see who registers the most steps in a week. In another study, Patel's verified the benefits of working within a group like your family to achieve your goals. But the key is individual accountability within that group setting.
You need some kind of individual reinforcement, but you also need someone there to support you. You need to feel accountable to a teammate, a family member, or a friend. That combination of social structure and reward incentives can really help us to achieve better outcomes than just using the device alone.
But what if you want to log 10,000 steps a day, but doing absolutely nothing at all?
Machines can do the work.
Unfitbits is a project that presents
solutions and ways that you might be able to spoof your fitness data. So you might be able to create or fabricate a fitness data set that makes it look like you're much more active than maybe you are.
Tiga Brain is a New York-based artist and data engineer who, together with Surya Matu, developed UnFitBits.
On our website, we have demonstrations of, you know, attaching fitness trackers to dogs or to metronomes or to anything that's going to create that sort of simulation of walking.
The UnFitBits project was a reaction to the likes of insurance companies, supermarkets, big business, even colleges and universities starting to trade incentives for access to individual health and fitness data.
About a year ago, we were both in New York City and we noticed that many insurance companies were advertising new programs where they would offer their customers discounts if they wore a Fitbit that was freely provided and if they logged a certain amount of steps per day. So usually the aim is to do 10,000 steps per day. And this would get you, you know, a few hundred dollars off your annual insurance bill. And we were really concerned by this because, for one, it seems that privacy is set to become this sort of luxury, right? Where if you can afford not to need discounts, you can afford not to share your fitness data set with someone like your insurance company. But also, what we've seen and what these programs show is that there's this sort of new market for personal activity data that is relatively obscure. You know, if I wear a Fitbit and I, you know, sign up to one of these reward programs, I'm not really sure like what's happening with my data and who it might be sold to or what that looks like. So for the first time, we're seeing a situation where tracking data and something like a Fitbit could be really useful for me to change my lifestyle and like do more exercise and so on. There's someone else in that relationship. It's not just me and my tracker. It's like me, my tracker, and these other entities. Yeah, which obviously has all these sorts of implications for privacy, and both now and in the future. Like, what happens to that if the company goes broke or if the terms and conditions change? There's lots of unknowns there.
The security of fitness tracker data is an important issue, and we'll get to that in a minute. But you want to know the best way to hack your step count, right? Well, here you go.
One of our fitness solutions was attaching a Fitbit to a drill. And if you spin the drill at a very high speed, it doesn't register it as a step. We were testing the limits of what it counts as a step and what it doesn't. But at a nice sort of moderate spin, it does, in fact, see that as a step. The best result we got was by attaching a Fitbit just to a swinging pendulum, like to a swinging string. But a metronome also works. I mean, anyone who's owned one of these fitness trackers and who may have, you know, left it in the pocket of your jeans and put your jeans through the dryer, you know, you'll notice that that too will give you a few thousand steps. So they're not objective by any means.
UnFitBits is obviously a satirical project, but the concerns that inspired it are on point. Questions like, who owns your fitness data? Where's it stored? How vulnerable is it to being hacked? And who can it be legally sold onto? Because, like me, you quickly agreed to the terms and conditions without reading them in a rush to strap that shiny new gadget to your arm. These are all questions that anyone who uses these devices should really be asking.
There is this kind of paradox almost that we own the device, but we don't really entirely own the data that this device collects. It's stored by the company's servers. We have an access to some level of summary, but it's sometimes really difficult to get to the raw data. And believe me, we were trying it with almost every device that were coming out on the market.
Which is a huge shift from how people have traditionally tracked their health and fitness. Deborah Lupton is a centenary research professor at the University of Canberra.
If it was our door jam at home, if it was our scales at home, if it was our diary or our journal at home, or even a spreadsheet on our computer for that matter, well, those data were kept private to us for the large part. But these days, because we are measuring ourselves with digital devices, those devices go up into the cloud. Once they go up, we lose any control that we may have over those details. And I think that's where there's a key issue that we need to consider in terms of who is accessing our personal details. What are the legal uses of those details and what are the illegal uses of those details?
But even if you're asking the right kind of questions, a lot of the time, they won't even have an answer. Robert Furberg.
You know, as recently as 2014 and 2015, reviews have revealed that upwards of 50% or more of some of the most popular health applications don't even have a privacy policy.
Data security concerns aside, there's genuine hope for the future of these devices in the healthcare setting. Lucas Pivek.
When people will be connected with those sophisticated biometric, biophysiological sensors, we'll be able to potentially predict particular conditions. There's this kind of ultimate holy grail of the medical devices that people will, in a way, take their own health into their own hands.
And in spite of claims that currently a lot of doctors don't really know what to do when patients turn up armed with spreadsheets full of health data, in some ways, Pivek's prediction is already playing out.
My name's Mark. I sweep surf boats and row. I'm on the beach at Milgola. And the marshal comes up and she said, "You don't look real well." And over I went on the beach with a heart attack. I got carted off to hospital, angioplasty, stent, and into cardio rehab. In cardio rehab, they asked if I would be part of a trial program Sydney Uni was doing in terms of assessing rehabilitation progression. They asked me to wear a Fitbit, and the Fitbit I found very helpful in being able to monitor and maintain a level of fitness that I was advised is required for full cardio rehabilitation.
The aim of our research is to be able to help people get back to good physical activity, to help them recover from the event and to do enough physical activity that they prevent further events.
Robin Gallagher is a professor of nursing at the University of Sydney, and it was her research project that recruited Mark during his cardiac rehabilitation.
There's two main aspects to physical activity for people who've had a heart attack. And the first of those is the duration, how long a person exercises. So we ultimately want people to exercise 30 minutes a day, at least 5 days a week, to a level where they're mildly short of breath. So people would time the amount of exercise they did and they would learn to monitor their shortness of breath. So we say you can talk, but you can't sing when you're walking or jogging or swimming or whatever. So before that, that's what people did. They guessed.
Gallagher's trying to take some of the guesswork out of cardiac rehabilitation. With the help of her PhD student, Marty Al-Harbi, she sought to validate fitness tracker data against the industry standard, a medical device called an actigraph.
I think most fitness trackers are generally accurate. It's nice that we've done this study so that we can use these much more easily in research and we can say to our patients now, this is accurate. Marty found that there's a 10% overcount, and that's primarily because we're wearing it on our wrist and not on our hip, for instance. But it is still accurate enough for patients to use on an everyday basis and for us to measure people's physical activity over a whole day.
Mark's involvement in the cardiac rehab study has given him an interesting perspective on these devices, one that rings true with everything else we've heard today.
The Fitbit is just a tool, among other tools that I have, which enable me to monitor my progress. But it is also a motivating factor. Simply by virtue of having that tool, it is a motivation in itself.
Sound engineer on today's show was Judy Rapley. As always, for more information, head to the Health Report website via the RN homepage. But that's it for this week. I'm Joel Werner.